You're listening to LGRadio.online. Welcome to In the Benny Green Archives.
Writing a song can only be done conventionally speaking. Either you're like Cole Porter and Noel Coward and Irving Berlin and you do the whole thing yourself, or you do half the job and find a partner to do the other half. Rodgers and Hart, Kern and Hammerstein, Coleman and Lee, and so on. After all, a song requires only two creative acts, writing the words and composing the music. But what do you do when there are three of you? And why seek out that triple arrangement in the first place? One man who might have been able to answer was Ray Henderson, born December the 1st, 1896, and a composer, pure and simple. As a matter of fact, he was a composer from the time he was 8 years old and never broke the habit, nor ever wanted to. Unlike so many of his rivals, Henderson never worked at any other job. In his teens, he was working as an accompanist in vaudeville. And it wasn't long before he met a lyricist who had been born in Odessa, Russia, where the borscht circuit means a plate of soup. The lyricist's name was Lou Brown, and it wasn't long before Brown and Henderson started writing successful songs. And it wasn't much longer before a third partner was recruited, one George Gard, known to us as Buddy De Silva, who had a pretty good track record, especially with George Gershwin, in the days before Ira woke up from his slumbers. Officially, Henderson worked at the tune, while the other two put words to it. In practice, it was a lot more confused than that. Henderson would often suggest lines or provide a rhyme, and sometimes Brown or De Silva would hum something that Henderson would pick up. It was the vaguest of methods and not always easy to work, but it flourished, especially in the madcap 1920s before Wall Street fell in a heap. You might even say that it was Henderson, De Silva and Brown who wrote the archetypal hymn of those easy days. It turned up in a musical about one of those American colleges where once a year the student body plays Hunt the Professor, and the official brochure describes the campus as a large football field with a small classroom attached. It was a time when all you had to do to get rich was phone your broker, always provided he could afford a phone.
The world belongs to everyone. Oh, the best things in life are free. And that old moon beams for everyone. Yes, it gleams there for you and me. Flowers in spring, the robins that sing, sunbeam that shines, baby, they're yours. Yes, and they are mine. And love can come to everyone, 'cause the best things in life are free. Take it, Saxon.
Water, the best things in life are free.
best things in life are free, or three, as people used to say of Henderson, De Silva and Brown in the days when they were really hot. What's difficult about following their path is that they kept splitting up and working with other partners, often to great effect. But it was the best things in life are free, most of all, that was the model for their finest hour. The show was called Good News, and it worked so well that the trio decided to keep on writing it. Their next three shows were the same show, only instead of football, it was golf, and then boxing, and then aeroplane racing. In 1928, the boxing show, Hold Everything, starring Burt Lahr, had a plot by De Silva that wouldn't have convinced a frog. But the songs went down pretty well, although not quite as well, perhaps, as the songs in Good News. In fact, only one item from Hold Everything has survived the show. It's a Liszt song, a catalogue of effects, a formula which was always appealing to lyric writers.
You're the cream in my coffee, you're the salt in my stew. You will always be my necessity, I'd be lost without you. You're the starch in my collar, you're the lace in my shoe. You will always be my necessity, I'd be lost without you. Now most men tell love tales, and each phrase dovetails. You've heard each known way, this way is my own way. Dear, you're the sail in my love boat, you're the captain and crew. You will always be my necessity, I'd be lost without you. Most guys tell love tales, and each phrase dovetails. You've heard each known way, this way is my own way. Dear, you're the sail in my love boat, you're the captain and crew. You will always be my necessity, I'd be lost without you.
You're the cream in my coffee, a Henderson, De Silva and Brown hit from the 1928 show Hold Everything. The only trouble with the songs of the 20s sometimes is that time has rendered them a little bit quaint and the lampooners attempted to move in. This certainly happened to Ray Henderson when he and his two partners perpetrated Sonny Boy, which has been reduced to ribaldry by more Rabelaisians than I dare think about. In fact, Sonny Boy was so awful that later, when they realised what they'd done, Henderson, De Silva and Brown worked up an excuse. Their story was that Al Jolson badly wanted a new song and they were a bit fed up with Jolson, so they decided to write the worst possible, silliest, most sickening song they were capable of and send it to Jolson, who naturally would reject it, and that would get them off the hook. But that was a big mistake. Nobody ever went broke underrating Jolson's taste, and when he heard Sonny Boy, Jolson loved it. A less spectacular but more entertaining example of Henderson's music being served up with custard is a song that he wrote just as he was entering in his arrangement with Brown and De Silva. His lyricist here was a man called Mort Dixon, who before he started writing songs had had a rigorous and very thorough training in the arts. Dixon graduated from high school and was immediately able to put his diplomas to advantage by getting a job as a bus conductor. This work was so rewarding that he decided to volunteer for the United States Army, and he loved being a soldier so much that soon he went back to bus conducting. Then he rejoined the army when America entered the Great War in 1917. When peace came, he went to work in a bank. But he found the ethics so dubious that he hungered for something a little bit more respectable. And that was how he ended up serving drinks in a Westchester bar. All this time, heredity and environment had been waiting to drag Mort Dixon into show business. His father managed a New York theatre, and his mother managed his father, besides being a professional actress. So that was the training that made Mort Dixon a songwriter. In 1926, he came up with a lyric for Henderson that became a kind of signature tune of the Roaring Twenties.
Packed up all my cares and woe, here I go swinging low. Bye-bye, little blackbird, where somebody waits for me, sugar sweet, so is she. Bye-bye, blackbird, no one here can love and understand me. Oh, what hard luck stories they all hand me. Make my bed and light the light, I'll arrive late tonight. Blackbird, bye-bye. Pack up all my cares and woe, here I go singing low. Bye, bye, blackbird, where somebody waits for me, sugar sweet, so is she. Blackbird, make my bed and light the light, I will arrive a little late tonight. Blackbird, bye-bye. Bird, bye-bye. One more time. Blackbird, bye-bye.
In more recent times, that song, which is surprisingly durable, it works as a standard or as an excuse for jazz improvisation, was taken up by a man with a sense of the ridiculous, so highly developed that it became a serious business. He wrote his own lyrics, and I commend for connoisseurs of the outre rhyme the use of the words Cambodia and archipelago.
My name is Charlie Bloomberg, and I travel everywhere, 'cause I'm a traveling salesman. So I fly from here to there. In every town I visit, folks must think I'm really swell, 'cause every time I leave a town, I get a fond farewell. Every time I fly away, people cry and they say, bye, bye, Bloomberg. It's a shame I have to go, seeing as how they miss me so. Bye, bye, Bloomberg. Once I took a trip with Irving Cohen, no one even noticed he was going. Me, they smashed across the head with champagne, and they said, Bloomberg, bye, bye. Pack my Playboy magazine, drip dry shirt and Dramamine. It's bye, bye, Bloomberg. All night long I'm like Don Juan, but sorry girls, I fly at dawn. Bye, bye, Bloomberg. The stewardess says fasten safety belt, sir. Then she serves me coffee, tea or seltzer. And each night when I retire, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir sings Bloomberg, bye-bye. I was in Cambodia. They don't say hello to ya. Just bye,
bye, bye, bye, bye.
Bloomberg.
Bye, bye, Bloomberg.
In the archipelagos, no matter where a fella goes, bye,
bye,
bye, Bloomberg.
Bye, bye, Bloomberg.
Even in Arabia, when I fly by, Abdel Nasser stands there waving bye, bye. And you'll see when I'm really gone, in neon lights at Forest Lawn, Bloomberg. Bye, bye. Beloved Bloomberg. Oh, Bloomberg. Bye, bye. Look up in the sky. You will find a Bloomberg of happiness.
Alan Sherman showing what you can do to quite a nice tune if you really put your mind to it. Like Spike Jones, Sherman never minded if the song was good or bad, so long as he could get a laugh out of it. So neither of them were really satirists so much as parodists. When Sherman set out to destroy Love Is Here to Stay, it was with no more ill feeling towards the song than Spike Jones had when he set about Laura. It wasn't this song or that that they were falling upon, but the whole conception of songwriting. Now for the Russian section. I said before that Lou Brown was born in Odessa, and so he was. He was all of 5 years old before he had the sense to leave town. And it was another 5 years after that, in 1903, that a Mr. Dukelski was born in the kind of environment that would have regarded Lou Brown as adequate ammunition when it came to throwing another peasant on the fire. Dukelski's father always claimed descent from the King of Georgia. Not the one that Hoagie Carmichael had on his mind, but the one in the Caucasus. Although how you can descend from a Caucasian king beats me, because they were just about as low as you could get without showing up in Australia. Anyhow, Dukelski Jr. attended Kiev Conservatory, but had to leave in a hurry when the revolution started. And by an odd coincidence, the first place the Dukelskis ran to was Lou Brown's hometown of Odessa. But by then, Lou was already a Tin Pan Alley veteran. Well, Vladimir Dukelski, the young lad, moved on and started arranging concerts at the Constantinople YMCA, which is not exactly the pinnacle of show business. But in 1921, he reached New York and was befriended by George Gershwin, who advised him to get lowbrow, as he put it. So Dukelski adopted the name of Duke. Imagine being so highly placed socially that to call yourself Duke was being lowdown. Still, to a man whose father thinks he's a king, I suppose it is. Anyway, Duke moved around, Paris, and then London, where he wrote a show for C.B. Cochrane called Yvonne, which Noel Coward slaughtered in a phrase, Yvonne the Terrible. Then back to America, and in 1932, his first full Broadway score for a show called Walk a Little Faster. It included lyrics by Yip Harburg and one of the all-time hits of the decade.
I never knew the charm of spring, never met it face to face. I never knew my heart could sing, never missed a warm embrace till April in Paris. Chestnuts in blossom, holiday tables under the tree. This is a feeling that no one can ever reprise. I charm of spring, I never met it face to face. And I never knew my heart could sing, never missed a warm embrace till can I run to? What have you done to my heart?
The song that was only added to the score of Walk a Little Faster as an afterthought. There was a general feeling that the show needed a touch of romance, and a remark by Dorothy Parker, who said, "Oh, to be in Paris now that April's there," set Yip Harburg off. He went and read some travel brochures about Paris, never having been there himself, and that was that. Now, naturally, a song like April in Paris knocked all the other songs sideways, which was a shame, because Yip Harburg worked particularly hard to get some smart rhymes in there. In a song called So Nonchalant, you can hear the Harburg mind ticking over, working up unexpected allusions and making them rhyme as naturally as Moon and June. In the Vernon Duke Yip Harburg show Walk a Little Faster, which opened way back at the beginning of December 1932. I'd better not leave the subject of Vernon Duke without touching on an aspect of it that's cropped up in a lot of listeners' letters over the past year, ever since I first introduced it. Now, that aspect is one of the very best bad novels in the English language. There is such a thing as a good bad novel, just as there's such a thing as a bad good one. I always think of Scott Fitzgerald's This Side of Paradise as a very bad good novel, for instance. But the other category is much more interesting. Books which are patently absurd and yet irresistibly readable. The best of the lot, I think, is The Prisoner of Zenda. And what's really fascinating is the fact that at least twice it's been done as a musical. One of my less rational ambitions is to do a program one day, complete with large orchestra and chorus, analyzing not only Romberg's Princess Flavia of the early 1920s and the 1937 straight version of David Selznick, but also Vernon Duke's parting Broadway shot, a 1964 attempt called Zenda. It certainly had one good song, where the Princess Flavia, twigging that she's going to have to marry the king even if he looks like a potato, confides to herself that though she'll do her duty, it might complicate matters if he should turn out to be not a potato at all, but a hot potato, which is quite different. Still, there are other plots than ours afoot tonight, as somebody says in the book, and we have to press on. This is the one known as the General Excuse Me Foxtrot, with the lights dimmed and the faces of the dancers dappled by the fleeting flashing lights from the glitter ball spinning round up on the ceiling. Most of the people here tonight are regulars, and they've come in the forlorn hope of meeting somebody who isn't a regular, someone new, someone to confirm for them the feeling that when the music sounds so romantic, surely love really is, like they say in the song, just around the corner. And meanwhile, the musicians grind on. They've been playing this number at this tempo at this point in the evening for the past 8 months, and they got fed up with it weeks ago. Already they're doodling on the music. The second trombone has a crossword puzzle propped up inside his music, and the baritone saxophone player is doing cartoons of the band leader's face. The rest of the band is keeping its eyes on the girls as they come swirling past in a cloud of perfume and musk. The girls look back at them. Sometimes they smile, and the musicians go into dumb play with eyes and fingers. They're trying to say without actually speaking, "I have just fallen madly in love with you. If you will meet me outside after the dance, I'll prove it." And then the girl's face drifts out of focus and another one just as good takes its place. This is the only way known to the Western world where strangers can embrace in public without causing a scandal. "Do you come here often? Can I take you home?" To which the girl sweetly replies, "Certainly. Where do you live?" Well, turning away now from the bright lights and the fallen angels of the musical comedy world, I come to the smoky nightclub room and the overcrowded studio. To the world of lost songs and forgotten artists. Now, when I was an apprentice musician, there were about four or five lady singers in the jazz world that anybody rated. Ella and Billy, of course, Mildred Bailey, Maxine Sullivan. In these programs, I have been drawing on Ella and Billy, hardly at all on Maxine Sullivan. I wasn't even sure if she was still alive. And even if she was, could she still be singing? And even if she was, could it sound much? Well, the old girl must be into her 70s by now. I find these records phenomenal, not just because this is an old lady we're listening to and we ought to make allowances, but because the singing is so good that no allowances are necessary. And the joy of hearing the vintage Sullivan was enhanced by two other factors: the perfection of the accompaniment and the inspired choice of material, most of it outstanding but neglected. How many people, for instance, even know of the existence of a song written for the Cotton Club Review of 1932 by Harold Arlen and Ted Kohler called That's What I Hate About Love? I had never heard of it. But how beautifully it now rises up in this amazing series of Maxine Sullivan albums.
I used to think to be in love meant everything. That's when I only knew the joy that it can bring. Now I have changed my song. The price we pay for joy is wrong. Why should I try to hide just how I feel inside? Just when happiness seems certain, fate steps in and slowly drops the curtain. Then your heart just falls apart. That's what I hate about love. One day life is cream and peaches, then from out of nowhere misery reaches. Right or wrong, it don't last long. That's what I hate about love. You make your mind up not to be blue, but in a wind-up you're only human. What can you do? Love affairs are like the weather. Paradise and hell are close together. Once you're hooked, your goose is cooked. That's what I hate about love. Can you do? Love affairs are like the weather. Paradise and hell are close together. Once you're hooked, your goose is cooked. That's what I hate about love. That's what I hate about love.
That's What I Hate About Love, Maxine Sullivan, and the tenor saxophone playing was by Al Klink. The album that track comes from is a Harold Arlen exclusive, but Maxine did another one devoted to the music of Burton Lane, and here again there were pearls unknown to me, and I guess other people too. In 1942, the Tommy Dorsey Band, complete with Frank Sinatra, was drafted into a terrible picture called Ship Ahoy, in which Eleanor Powell danced her way to victory over some enemy spies. Really, the plot's not worth talking about, except that there was a number by Burton Lane and Yip Harburg that was sung in the picture by three or four of the actors, including Sinatra. Now, I don't remember this episode at all, but the point is that the structure of the song is worth a hearing, and Maxine Sullivan is perfect for it. Although the original placing of the song was on board ship, really this is a typical late-night song, and it cries out for small group jazz treatment, which is what it gets.
Sorry you're not me. for you will never know what loving you can be. Poor you, you'll never know your charms. You'll never feel your warmth. You're never in your arms. When it is you I'm kissing, I pity you constantly. You don't know what you're missing, for you're only kissing poor me. Poor you. You'll live your whole life through, and yet you'll never know the thrill of loving you.
By Burton Lane and Yip Harburg, written for a 1942 picture called Ship Ahoy and rescued there by Maxine Sullivan. In a sense, the case of Lee Wiley was similar to Maxine Sullivan's. Miss Wiley was a singer I'd heard briefly in passing half a lifetime ago and then forgot all about. I had a vague idea I'd read about her death a few years back, but what really put me in mind of her was a letter from a listener to the effect that one time he'd found his way into Ernest Hemingway's home in Cuba. And seen there among the books and the bric-a-brac and the lumps of old fish and bits of dead bulls, a record collection which included virtually the entire output of Lee Wiley. That set me thinking, and it wasn't all that reassuring. I like Lee Wiley, and fancy having something in common with Ernest Hemingway. I wasn't excited about that at all. But slowly I came round, hunted up some of Miss Wiley's later recordings and was handsomely rewarded. Apparently in middle life, Miss Wiley got married to a great deal of money indeed. So this song, with its rarely heard set of lyrics, seems like a personal statement on her behalf.
I'm not the girl who cared about money. I'm not the girl who cared about fortunes and such. Never cared much. Oh, look at me now. I never knew rhinestone from rubies. I never knew a mink from a sable or seal. Ponies from reed. Oh, look at me now. Got a new man. What a man. He's no handsome Merrill Flynn. I like his face and his bank is Chase. Half a million dollars ain't ten. So I'm the girl long for a cottage. So I'm the girl who's got an estate with a gate. I'm doing great. Oh, look at me now. I've got more than I deserve. I sleep till two, then what do? Pour the wine and serve the hors d'oeuvre. Oh, I'm the gal who's married to Wall Street. Yes, I'm the gal who's worth about 500 G's, at which don't sneeze. Oh, look at me now.
Lee Wiley with Bobby Hackett on trumpet, Oh Look At Me Now. Obscure verses to well-known choruses. The most outstanding verse of all that I heard sung properly for the first time came only the other day in a further instalment from the prolific campaign of Capitol Records to offer us revivals. One of its new old Nat Cole issues is called Two in Love. And for me, the high spot was a song which I've featured in these programs before and have been playing as a musician for at least 25 years, but I never knew the verse. Now here is that verse, divorced from its familiar chorus. And how many people, I wonder, will be able to put a name to it?
This is our last dance together. Tonight soon will be long ago. And in our moment of parting, this is all I want you to know. There will be many other nights like this. And I'll be standing here with someone new. There will be other songs to sing, another fall, another spring. But there will never be another you. There will be other lips that I may kiss, but they won't thrill me like yours used to do. Yes, I may dream a million dreams, but how can they come true if there will never ever be another you? Yes, I may dream million dreams, but how can they come true if there will never ever be another?
Nat Cole, There'll Never Be Another You, verse and chorus by Harry Warren. I was delighted to see that Rosemary Clooney followed up her excellent Sings Gershwin with a Sings Ireland and then a Sings Berlin, and then, will this never end, Sings Cole Porter, including one of the all-time great catalogue songs. A listener wrote in a couple of weeks ago, quoting from a very academic book indeed, in which the words of this song have been mangled into examination texts by some conspiracy of pretentious fatheads. That still leaves simple souls like us to enjoy the thing in our innocence.
You're the top, you're the Colosseum, you're the top, you're the Louvre Museum, you're a melody from a symphony by Strauss, you're a Bendel bonnet, a Shakespeare sonnet, you're Mickey Mouse, you're the Nile, you're the Tower of Pisa, you're the smile on the Mona Lisa. I'm a worthless check, a total wreck, a flaw, but if baby I'm the bottom, you're the top.
Simply too, too, too divine. You're a Botticelli, you're Keats, you're Shelley, you're Ovaltine. You're a rose, you're Inferno's Dante. You're the nose of the great Durante. I'm a nominee of the GOP or GOP, but if baby I'm the bottom, you're the top.
Rosemary Clooney, You're the Top. The tenor saxophone playing was by Scott Hamilton, the guitar playing by Cal Collins, and on piano was Nat Pierce. Anyway, that's it for now. See you same time next week.
You've been listening to In the Benny Green Archives here on lgradio.online. Please do visit the website to find out when the next episode is on, along with all our other shows. This is lgradio.online. Thanks for listening.